Hello, good evening, and welcome to tonight's program featuring our honored guest, Dr. Daniel Pipes. My name is Reuven Elberger, and I'm a Columbia Law School student. I will be the moderator for tonight's event. Before I introduce Dr. Pipes, I want to point out that this event is sponsored by Kolenu Law Students for Israel. Kolenu is an all-but-forgotten law school group in years past, but through efforts of some capable law students, we've resurrected it. And I believe that Kolenu plays an important role in our law school in bringing to light the vital issues facing Israel today. Kolenu takes pride in being a vocal part of the Columbia Law School, as a law school is still a place where students and scholars listen to each other in a civil manner and share thoughts and ideas respectfully. Tonight, I want us to continue the law school tradition of listening to each other's ideas respectfully. With that in mind, Dr. Pipes will lecture for about 20 minutes, after which I will moderate a 40-minute question and answer session open to all of us. We are honored tonight to have Dr. Pipes share his thoughts with us this evening. Dr. Pipes is director of the Middle East Forum, whose mission is to promote American interests through its various projects, such as its publication of the Middle East Quarterly, its lecture series, and its website, campuswatch.org, which reviews, critiques, and tries to improve Middle Eastern studies in universities. Dr. Pipes is a prize-winning columnist, appearing regularly in the New York Sun, Philadelphia Evening Bulletin, and Jerusalem Post. Dr. Pipes also has appeared on news programs such as ABC World News, Crossfire, and Nightline, and internationally on the BBC and Al Jazeera. A graduate of Harvard, Dr. Pipes is known around the world as an acute observer of the troubles brewing in the Middle East, leading the Boston Globe to speculate, quote, if Pipes' admonitions had been heeded, there might never have been a 9/11. His topic this evening is the threat to Israel's existence, why it's back, and what it means. Thank you.
Thank you, Reuven, for the kind introduction. I'd like also to thank Morty Searle for putting the event together, and also to Dean Michelle Greenberg-Coburn for overseeing tonight's event, which was not simple, actually, to arrange. I'm just in from sunny California, from Malibu, where I'm teaching, and I'm so pleased that you in the East have managed for me a reminder of a real Eastern winter. I normally live in Philadelphia, so it's good to wear the boots again. My subject is the threat to Israel's existence, and I think it's striking how voices from far and near are coming out against the continued existence of the Jewish state. And this takes two forms, what I'll call the polite form and the crude form. The crude form is what Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, is calling for, eliminating Israel from the map, presumably through violence, if not atomic weaponry. It brings to mind Gamal Abdel Nasser in the 1960s, calling for Arabs to throw the Jews into the sea. There are other calls of this sort. An Egyptian parliamentarian just a few days ago said that in the aftermath of the fracas on the Temple Mount, that Israel needs to be destroyed through nuclear weaponry, and there's no other solution to it. But by and large, this kind of direct physical destruction of Israel, crude call for Israel's elimination, is not the main way that the opponents of Israel discuss things. Rather, they engage in what I call polite threats. For example, demanding that Palestinians have a right to return to Palestine, i.e., demographically overrun Israel and change its nature from a Jewish state to a non-Jewish state. Declaring a jihad to liberate Jerusalem, as Yasser Arafat used to do. Commemorating the creation of Israel as a Nakba, or the disaster, which is something one hears on Palestinian television. Proposing a one-state solution, i.e., there be no more Israel. The Jewish population be part of a one-state or binational state. This has many proponents in this very university. Three that come to mind are the late Edward Said, Rashid Khalidi, and Joseph Massad. Then there are tributes to all those who have given their lives for the cause of the Palestinian people, including, of course, suicide bombers, something one hears at the United Nations. there is a constant refrain regretting that Israel came into existence. It was a mistake. It shouldn't have happened. Now, these polite versions of calling for the end of Israel's existence are quite widespread in the West. You don't hear people calling for the nuclear attack on Tel Aviv, but you do hear people saying that Israel was a mistake, Israel shouldn't exist, there should be a one-state solution, there should be a binational solution, there should be a right of return. For example, the mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, said just recently, "I would not have created an Israel." American professors often refer to this. Journalists do. Here's Faisal Bodhi writing in The Guardian a few years ago. "Israel, as it is constitutionally and legally configured, has no moral right to exist, and a single-state solution is the only way of achieving a practical justice." Richard Cohen, writing in The Washington Post a year ago, said that Israel itself is a mistake. Tony Kushner, the artist, the playwright, called the establishment of Israel a mistake. It would be better if Israel never happened. Even Jewish leaders. Anthony Lehrman, the executive director of the Institute for Jewish Policy Research in London, said a couple of years ago, "Israel and Zionism are failures, and that Israel should be transformed into a binational state." In short, Zionism is at issue. Zionism, being defined as the idea of a Jewish state, is being called a 19th century ideal, is being called racist, it is being called something that is no longer acceptable in the world today. What is striking about this is that things were not always this way. In fact, 15 years ago, at the time before Oslo and Oslo Agreement of 1993, the issue of Israel's existence as a Jewish state was settled. Everyone seemed to agree, including Yasser Arafat. There were few voices, certainly nothing like these, in the West, in important positions and with authoritative influence. There were few voices calling for the elimination of the Jewish state. So the question is, why, after this approach seemingly disappeared, has it returned? And what does it mean? And what lessons can one draw from these new circumstances? Now, there are multiple causes of any such development, including the rise of radical Islam, the second wind of the revolution in Iran, the general turn of the left in the West against Israel. But I'd like to focus on what I think are perhaps the most critical mistakes, and those are mistakes made by Israel itself. And that will be my focus here. It is my thesis that Israel is today paying for the mistakes it made 15 years ago. And the mistake I would point to as the most crucial one was made by the then Prime Minister of Israel, who said on more than one occasion, "You don't make peace with your friends, you make peace with your enemies." And he followed up, when he was in office, between 1992 and his assassination in 1995, Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin followed up by, in fact, doing that, making peace with his enemies, and primarily Yasser Arafat and the PLO. The Israelis under Rabin made concessions, gave land, agreed to funding, agreed to arms, agreed to a paramilitary force being put together and trained, agreed to the coming into existence of a proto-state, in return for which it was expected that the Israelis would benefit by a further reduction in hostility and violence. That, in other words, the Israelis would give to their enemies and the enemies would reply in kind, cultural, human, economic contacts, by teaching children that Israel was acceptable, by having mosque sermons that did not dwell on Jews, and so forth. problem was in Rabin's formulation. You don't make war with your enemy. You make war with your former enemy. You make war with someone who is no longer your enemy, who has given up the goal of defeating you. It's a huge difference. Making peace with your enemy implies that concessions, land, money, arms, and so on, will win your enemy over. Making peace with your former enemy implies that you can only make peace once your enemy has stopped trying to make war on you. The Israeli, after Yitzhak Rabin, the Israeli leadership continued in his mold and continued to make gestures of symbolism and substance to the Palestinians in the hopes that something would cause them to reciprocate. But in fact, if one looks closely at the Palestinians between the years 1993 and 2000, during the course of the Oslo diplomacy, you see that quite the opposite happened, because Palestinians were still looking at Israel in a war mode, and therefore they responded by assessing the Israeli motives for these concessions and concluded that the Israelis had done so out of a sense of weakness and vulnerability, and that they, the Palestinians, could benefit from this mistake by pressing their cause harder. And so rather than reciprocate, what one found between 1993 and 2000 was a Palestinian body politic that became enraged, that became exhilarated, that became more ambitious, that the embers of anti-Zionism in 1992-3 were fanned into a conflagration. And I like to make the contrast symbolically between the handshake on the White House lawn in 1993, when Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat shook hands, a symbol of diplomacy, of peacemaking at its best, it seemed, and then the symbol of the end of this process in the year 2000, October 2000, when two reservists of the Israeli army went astray in Ramallah and were lynched. And the young man who just lynched them came out and showed his bloodied hands to the international media. So he went from these two hands to those two hands. That's what Oslo wrought. It took a shaking of hands and turned it into murderous hands. In other words, Oslo was premature. It's not that the premise was wrong, that the Israelis get security and recognition in return for the Palestinians getting dignity and acceptance, but it was too early. You couldn't have negotiations in 1993. You could only have negotiations that would work once the Palestinians had given up on their goal of destroying or eliminating Israel. And that had not happened in 1993. I draw the conclusion from this that negotiations can only work when one side has given up. Now, there are two sides at war here, and either side could give up. The Israelis could give up on the Zionist dream, could give up on Israel. They could give up on a Jewish state. They could leave, they could be murdered, or they could submit to a different order. The Palestinians can give up by accepting Israel's existence as a Jewish state. Those, I believe, ladies and gentlemen, are the only two final status agreements or arrangements that will be permanent. In other words, only when one side gives up, and gives up thoroughly and completely and permanently, its goals, the Zionist dream for the Israelis, ending the Zionist dream for the Palestinians, will one reach a stable equilibrium, what is called peace. It can be a peace without Israel or a peace with Israel. I wish one could draw a line and have a compromise. But all efforts to do that, particular, Oslo, have failed, have made it worse. And so I draw the conclusion that negotiations are premature, that negotiations should follow on that defeat rather than precede it. And I would extend that further. There should be also, I would extend it further and say that the way forward is not through negotiations, but through one side giving up. And each of us has a choice. We can pick the Israeli side to win, or we can pick the Palestinian side to win. Palestinian, Arab, Muslim. It's a choice that each of us can make. And I would say we have no further choice. There is no third choice of a compromise. I wish there were. There isn't. And so each of you, ladies and gentlemen, must decide. I know which choice I make. I would like to see a dynamic, successful, democratic, liberal state in place. I do not want to see its destruction, elimination. You make your choices. But I will argue that if one is to have an Israel secure and permanent, that means the Palestinians in particular, and beyond them other Arabs and Muslims, must come to terms with this state, must accept it. And to reach that status, and this is the tough part, to reach that status, they must endure a defeat. They must go through the bitter crucible, the unpleasant experience of realizing that their war goals are unattainable. That does not happen by receiving funds. It does not happen through discussions of the Palestinian state. It does not happen by building a military. It does not happen through negotiations. It happens through defeat. Defeat means having given up the hope of achieving your goal. Defeat occurs when the victorious side crushes the will to fight of the defeated side. That is the process, I believe, that must take place here. Either the Israeli will is crushed to fight, or the Palestinian will to fight is crushed. One or other has to give up. And it is basically a psychological matter. It is not a battlefield. It's not two armies clashing. It rarely is these days. That's not how the United States lost in Vietnam. It's not how the Soviets lost in Afghanistan. It's not how things are transpiring in Iraq. It's much more to do with the psychological state. Who feels confident? Who feels things are going his way? And who is despairing? And there is certainly a military component to this, but it's not primarily military. And if you look at, say, Vietnam, it was not primarily military. It's not the United States was losing on the battlefield in Vietnam. No, it was domestic discontent with the nature of the war. It was a psychological, political evolution in this country that led us to conclude as a country that we had no future in Vietnam. We could not achieve our goal in Vietnam. And so the way forward in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is not through military operations primarily. It's not through negotiations. It is through a complex strategy on either side of getting the opposite side to give up. As I hope it will be the Palestinians who will give up, then I think the burden is on the Israelis to make that happen. And it is our burden, as the main ally of Israel, to help the Israelis make that happen. It is our burden to help the Israelis find a way to get the Palestinians to give up. Let me conclude by noting that having to give up would be the best thing that's ever happened to the Palestinians. Palestinian life today is not a good one. Schools and hospitals do not operate, function normally. Children are going off to engage in suicide bombing. There's a virtual civil war, or quasi-civil war, between the forces of the PLO and Hamas. There's a cult of death. There's a tyrannical streak in the leadership. Things are not getting better in the PA. Only when the Palestinians give up on their dream of eliminating Israel can they turn to their own affairs, tend to their own garden, build their own polity, economy, society, and culture. Only when the Palestinians are unburdened from this foul dream of eliminating a neighbor can they, in fact, prosper themselves. So, ironically, it's not just the Israelis who would gain by this, who obviously would gain by the Palestinians giving up, but it's also the Palestinians themselves who would benefit, prosper, as a result of giving this up. And therefore, I call on us, as Americans, to do what we can to see that the Israelis end this Palestinian dream of destruction and elimination. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Pipes. At this time, I'm going to be moderating a Q&A session open to everyone. Just keep in mind that our time this evening is very brief, so we want to keep our questions concise. We all have very strong opinions, obviously, on the matter, but please ask questions only, maybe about a minute, and if you go into declaratory statements, I might have to cut you off just to be fair to everybody else. And we really don't want to ruin the law school's reputation of engaging in very civil dialogue here. So, if you want to ask a question, just raise your hand. I'll call on you. You can stand up and state your name and then ask your question. In the back.
I don't think that colonialism was the issue in Vietnam. This is not the time and place to argue what happened in Vietnam. But the basic reason why the United States lost was not that the Vietnamese were so successful on the battlefield, that they were so capable of defending or going on the defense or offense. No, the United States and its South Vietnamese ally were winning on the battlefield. The origins of the defeat were here on the campuses and had to do with students who didn't like the character of the war, didn't want to go fight themselves, convinced others that this was an unnecessary war, but colonialism was not the issue on either side. It certainly was not the issue here. Colonialism was not the issue in the United States. My point in bringing up Vietnam was that it was a domestic American debate, and finally those who argued against continuing the war won. However it was seen, without going into that and arguing that in Vietnam, it didn't matter. It was how it was seen here. It was the opposition to the war here. Now, that could happen on the Israeli side. The Israelis could come to the conclusion that the Zionist dream of an Israeli state with a Star of David on the flag, mention of Jewish spirit in the national anthem, a law of return exclusively for Jews, the privileging of Hebrew over Arabic and other languages, all that is out the window, as some are calling. Post-Zionists are saying, this was fine, but it's no longer relevant. And it could be that post-Zionism defeats Zionism. I don't know. But it will be fundamentally a domestic Israeli conclusion. If, on the other hand, the Palestinians are the ones to conclude that the gig is up, and they can no longer continue, and that Israel's there, and it's permanent, and it's strong, and it's nothing they can affect, it will be as a result of an internal Palestinian conversation on this subject, argument on this subject. Is Israel something that we Palestinians can eliminate, or is it just too strong? And eventually those who say it's just too strong will prevail, and the Palestinians will give up. But in short, it's not about colonialism. It's about internal debates in Israel or in the Palestinian Authority or in other countries.
By the way, let me just comment that that was a perfect question in terms of length, and so let's try to keep that model. Okay, you, sir. Just state your name first and ask the question.
Did everyone hear the question? I lost my mic. Question was, what about the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty, which did not follow the pattern I'm suggesting? No, it did not follow the pattern. And indeed, I think that's why it's a failure. I think it's a failure not because the Egyptians and Israelis have gone to war since 1979, but because the great bulk of Egyptians, a recent survey showed 92%, consider Israel an enemy. In other words, what happened in 1979, or the whole process between 77 and 79, was that an unelected leader of Egypt, for reasons of his own, decided to reach a treaty with Israel, and he did so. He returned from this treaty to quiet streets in Cairo. There was a hostility to it. There was an anger that, in some fashion, led to his assassination 2 years later, though not directly. And since 1979, there has been a precipitous increase in anti-Israel sentiments. I lived in Egypt for 3 years in the 1970s. Israel was not a subject that came up. Israel was a Palestinian's problem. There was little enthusiasm for being involved in this. There was a sense I had that Egyptians gave their proxy to the government. We don't like Israel, but the government's taking care of it. We don't have to think about it. After the peace treaty was signed in 1979, Egyptians said, our government has betrayed us. We must take this over. And since then, you have such phenomena as the runaway single I Hate Israel song, these astonishing polls that show wall-to-wall antagonism towards Israel or denying Israel's right to exist. The build-up by the military of a significant military force, a modern military force, very different from the ones it had under the Soviet auspices. I don't think the Egyptian peace treaty was a success. Granted, there's been no war. But the tensions within Egyptian society are leading in that direction. And I would not be surprised, given the sentiments and the arsenal that one finds in Egypt, if there were a future or some form of hostilities between Egypt and Israel. In short, I'm saying that conflict wasn't ended. Yeah, a peace treaty was signed by an unelected ruler, Anwar Sadat. But no, the Egyptians didn't agree to it. Even more dramatically in the case of Jordan. In Jordan, it was a monarch who'd been on the throne for some 40 years in 1994 when he signed an even warmer agreement with Israel. And yet the clear civil society reaction to that signing was no thank you. There were some interesting anecdotes of Israelis discovering that you could get your dental work more cheaply done and just as well done in Amman as in Jerusalem, and going off to Amman. And then the Jordanian dental syndicate said any dentist who treats an Israeli will be thrown out and, you know, lose his income. Some artists went to Israel, and roof fell on them for doing that. And businessmen who tried to have deals with Israel found that the pressure was too heavy to continue with it. So the government said, sure, go ahead. But civil society said no. And even one can see this in the Palestinian case, where Yasser Arafat in 1993 signed an agreement with Israel recognizing its security needs and so forth. Now, I don't think he was serious about it. He wasn't honest about it. It was fraudulent. But nonetheless, he did do it. And the reaction in September 1993 among Palestinians was overwhelmingly negative. There was not a willingness to go along with it. So I conclude from these three cases that there needs to be a change of heart. There needs to be something deeper than a piece of paper. That a piece of paper can memorialize a change of heart, but it can't move history. A piece of paper is virtually irrelevant. And if you point out there's been no fighting between Egypt and Israel, I can point out there's been no fighting between Syria and Israel. That doesn't mean that things are fine. It just means there's been no fighting for a couple of decades. It's not the solution. The solution lies in people accepting that the neighbor is there and not trying to eliminate it. So I don't see the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty as a contradiction to what I'm arguing. I see it as a confirmation.
All the way in the back, sir.
How can the Israelis get down to business? It's remarkable that in Israel there is no politician of any standing that I know of who is saying what I'm saying. There are some ex-politicians, there's some thinkers, but no active politician that I know of is saying Israel needs victory. They're all saying Israel needs resolution, compromise. At this point, it's a matter of imagination, a matter of understanding the nature of war, that you make peace with your former enemy. I expect sooner or later the Israelis will turn and return to this, because they did very well understand this in the old days. But at the moment, it's out of favor. And what one sees is a topsy-turvy kind of situation. The Israelis are really breaking new ground with this concept of enfranchising and building up your enemy, of sending money to your enemy. $100 million a few days ago to Mahmoud Abbas, who is clearly an enemy of Israel, wants its elimination. But playing a tactical game so that he has an advantage over Hamas. But more broadly, with going beyond tactics, giving the Palestinians territory to run by themselves, autonomy, and hoping that this will turn them away from war. Hoping that a late model car and a nice apartment, good schools for the kids, will seduce Palestinians away from anti-Zionism. It hasn't. It won't. Such an idea has no historical grounding, but the Israelis are. I can't say they're still as active at it. There's a sense that it didn't work, but there's no contrary sense that victory is what's needed. So there's a certain sense of befuddlement. The Oslo process is not looked upon as a success. The two unilateral withdrawals from Lebanon and Gaza in 2000 and 2005 are not seen as success. So there's a certain languor and lack of ideas, but victory is certainly not on the table.
Sir.
Well, I think I was clear about defeat. What I didn't go into was tactics, how to achieve it. I think I made it clear that it's psychological, primarily. It's not military. It's not great armies meeting on a plane and fighting it out. That's not what this is. It's about an argument within Israeli society and Palestinian society. Who thinks that, how many think and how powerful they are in their arguments that you can win, and those who say you can't win. Psychological, primarily. The Palestinian use of suicide terrorism is an attempt to convince the Israelis they can't win. You can't win. You can't be safe, leave the country, foreign investors don't invest here. This is a losing proposition. Give up. The Israelis, in turn, are using methods which they hope, or they have at times, not at present really, but at times, say, during the first 2-3 years of Sharon's prime ministry, they used tactics which were military tactics which are designed to send a signal to the Palestinians that you can't win. But what I haven't talked about, so I think I'm clear on that, psychological, but what I haven't talked about and don't really want to get into are tactics. How much military, how much economic, how much psyops, how much this, how much that. I'm not in the field. I'm not running any campaign. What I'm trying to do is explain the nature of victory and defeat, how the Arab-Israeli conflict will end. I'm giving you my wishes for how I hope it will end, but beyond my own wishes is an explanation of how it will end. It's not going to end through signatures on a piece of paper. It's going to end by one side giving up. I don't know which one. I have my preferences for which one, but I don't know which one. I'd rather not get into tactics, because tactics are in the future. More important to me is to talk about the goals, the strategy, the policy. What is the goal here? How and what can we, as a country, as a government, add to this mix?
Sir, in front.
My name is Fred. I wanted to ask about, as you know, in the 70s and 80s, there was an alliance between the Christian militias in Lebanon and Israel, and that alliance was furthered through President Bashir's mail. I was wondering if you thought there could be an opportunity for that to happen again.
Is there any future for Christian, Lebanese Christian Israeli relations?
Well, it could be a model, I guess, for other countries to see that, because I mean, the Christians in Lebanon did see a common interest with Israel, and I think if something like this were to materialize, it would probably be a good sign.
I would tend to doubt it. That did not end up in a very successful way. The Israelis supported, in particular, the Maronites, but more broadly the Christians, back in the early 1980s. But their side pretty much lost. And the final denouement of this came in 2000, when the Israelis, one fine day, May 23rd, decided to up and out, leaving their Lebanese Christian allies in the lurch. Some of them, 7,000-8,000, they brought to Israel. Others suffered the consequences in Lebanon. I think the Lebanese Christians have a very great skepticism of Israel, deservedly. The Israelis did not play, did not sustain the responsibilities. And I would be loath to see this as a model for future Israeli relations with other peoples of the Middle East. No, it was, or in retrospect, it was a failure.
I'm sorry to follow up, but do you think that Israel has interest in trying to pursue that, or is it?
Well, the Israelis have followed two different approaches at different times, and it's at times they have said the Sunni majority of the Middle East is what we have to deal with. And let's confront it. This is our main enemy. And let's deal with it in either through negotiations or through war, but this is who we have to focus on. And at other times, they have tried to work with the non-Sunni majority, Arab-Sunni majority. So it could be the non-Arab Sunnis of Lebanon, of whom there are many, and especially with the Maronites. It could be with the Turks, the Iranians, the Kurds of Iraq, and perhaps elsewhere. the Ethiopians, you name it, anyone who's not part of that majority population. By and large, that minority policy hasn't succeeded very well. It is ultimately the Sunni Arab population that will make the decision of war and peace. They'll say, okay, Israel, we accept you, or Israel, we don't accept you.
Sir, in the back, in the middle.
On Iran, I think there are three possible outcomes. The best of which is that the Iranians themselves stop the march towards nuclear weaponry. And that's not implausible, because Iran is a country with multiple power centers. The Ahmadinejad tangent is opposed by significant portions of the population, as was expressed in the election, the municipal elections in December, expressed by one quarter of the parliament in a letter to Ahmadinejad, expressed by the Rahbar, the spiritual guide, in his quasi-criticism. There are the Bazaris, there are the students, there are the religious leadership who can indicate they don't like this, and are to some extent doing so. And that would be the ideal, if they could cause this not to happen. And the basic argument would be, Iran has no military threat at present. Iran could be economically prospering, but following this route to nuclear weaponry endangers the country militarily. The chance of being attacked is substantially higher, and interferes with its economic growth. The U.S. government is putting severe pressure on companies and countries not to invest in Iran, and it's working. It's working. Given a choice between antagonizing the Iranians and antagonizing the United States, most companies are going to take a pass on Iran. And they're feeling the pinch. So one can make a strong nationalist argument in Iran that this is not a wise idea. This is conjuring up a threat, a danger, and a problem that doesn't otherwise exist. That would be the ideal. Less ideal would be a U.S. attack on Iran, on the nuclear infrastructure, to destroy and thereby set back the nuclear program. This would have the many unpleasant consequences for everyone: a spike in the price of oil, well, not for everyone, but for us; larger and more intense hostility to this country around the world, especially among Muslims; a hugging of the government by Iranians; many unpleasant developments. And finally, the third and worst alternative is that we just let it happen. And not only do the Iranians have the nuclear bomb and all that that entails, but it is also a green light to all those other countries that have signed the NPT. It's meaningless. Go ahead. And nuclear weapons really proliferate. You mentioned the possibility of Israeli action. It is conceivable in two different ways. One would be that the Israelis use their sea-based nuclear weapons, hard to imagine, but conceivable. And the other is that the Israelis basically loan American platforms and ordnance and use American bases in Iraq, or at least American-controlled airspace over Iraq, to attack Iran. In other words, what I'm getting at is the Israelis themselves, from what I know, do not have the weaponry to attack Iran. Only the United States does. So basically, we're putting an Israeli pilot in an American machine and have the Israeli nominally make it, put an Israeli flag on the outside, but it's an American operation at base with American cooperation. So that really is an American operation. And if it's an American operation, why have an Israeli pilot? So it really devolves down to nuclear weapons. And there was a report in the Sunday Times in January that suggested the Israelis were ready to do that. That's good disinformation. Were they really ready to do it? I don't know. I tend to doubt it, but who knows? I think it's just those three prospects. The Iranians themselves stop it, we stop it, the U.S. government stops it, or it goes through.
I just want to take a little halftime break to thank the Columbia administration and the security for making sure that everything's been running smoothly. Okay, that was better than Prince, right? Let's see. You, sir, in the back. You, sir. Yes.
Well, I should be asking you that question, not you, me. Could you just, one question, how did Edward Said come up in biology class on the part of the students? Well, thank you for the invitation to talk about Middle East studies and the Middle East debate at Columbia. That's a subject that I have spent some time on. It was, some of you may know, my organization, Campus Watch, that first identified the problem of Middle East studies at Columbia. And it was then others, such as the David Project, who took this information and went and dramatized it and went public with it. So I and my Campus Watch project have been involved with the Columbia Middle East studies for some time. Let me indicate that, maybe explain that the Campus Watch, despite its name, looks quite narrowly at specialists on Middle East studies. We do not deal with administrators. We do not deal with biologists. We do not deal with English professors, with rare exceptions. And we do not deal with students. We deal with people who have PhDs on the Middle East, dealing with some aspect of the Middle East. And we have found that of all major universities in the United States, all research universities in the United States, there is a polarization and a one-sidedness in this university that is unique and that is dangerous. Your testimony, personal testimony, confirms that. Our general solution, and solution particular for Columbia, is that others get involved, that appointments on these delicate, important subjects be one in which the stakeholders in the university have a say, in which extreme views, intimidating views, are at least balanced by centrist views, if not excluded. Our goal has been to have a balance, have more than a single viewpoint expressed. And I think it's critical that the Middle East specialists reflect this, because it is they, ultimately, who set the tone for the discussion of the Middle East. And if there is a lively debate among Middle East specialists, then there can be an opening for a debate among other professors and students and others. But that debate does not exist, and it specifically does not exist on this campus. Your Middle East studies specialists are all on one side, with the very most minimum of exceptions. of exception. And that, I think, is the heart of the problem. So the key is to get alumni, trustees, the media, and everyone aware of the problem, which is what we did. And I think now there is a greater chance of inviting specialists, Middle East specialists, with alternative points of view. I don't think it's going to happen soon. It'll be a long, hard effort, but I do think that's the key, is getting the Middle East specialists to represent a broader spectrum of opinion than what it is today. And then other things will follow from that.
Ma'am, in the front.
Good point. Why would the Palestinians come to the conclusion they can't defeat Israel when they have such broad Arab, Muslim, European, UN, editorial writers, academics, and so forth behind them? And there's no question that the Palestinian cause, being a favorite cause around the world of many, gives the Palestinians a great sense of support and material support, whether it be arms from Iran, what they call peace shields from the West, UN resolutions, editorials, classes where there's intimidation dealing with the Middle East. All of these are helpful to them. And were the Palestinians to be abandoned by everyone, they would be far, far weaker. No question that that's an important factor. At the same time, all those are secondary considerations. And if you look back at 2001 through 2003, when the Sharon government was making an effort to signal to the Palestinians that they have lost and they can't win, you will see a precipitous decline in Palestinian morale as a result of that. Because what mattered more than some UN resolution or some class somewhere was their own assessment of their prospects. And their assessment at that time was bleak. So, as important as it is, I think all those, the whole support team, as important as it is secondary. And what, as a corollary of that, I think Israel has a break. Israel has few breaks, but one of them is it doesn't need to defeat the entire Arab or Muslim population, which is impossible. It only needs to defeat the Palestinians. When the Palestinians come to the conclusion that the game is over and they've lost and Israel's there and it's permanent, then that sense will then spread to others who are in the Palestinian camp, the Arabs, the Muslims, the left, you name it, and they will give up as well. Because if the Palestinians are no longer in this, then no one else really is. And it's interesting that there are other levels of this conflict. There are, for example, there's the Iranian level. But the Iranian level doesn't have resonance around the world. It's what I call the external Palestinians. It's the PA, in particular, that has this massive impact, say, at Columbia University, on the way people feel and see things. It's not the Israeli Arabs. It's not the Iranian government. It's the external Palestinians. And if the external Palestinians would say it's over, then I think pretty much everyone would say, if they say it's over, it's over. The only exception would be the internal Palestinians, who actually live in Israel, who constitute about one-fifth, one-sixth of the population, and who might continue to say, well, that is over. The attempt to either nuke Israel or use suicide bombs against Israel. But what still exists is our demand to get rid of the Star of David and to make Arabic co-equal with Hebrew and to make this a state of all citizens. And I think ultimately that is Israel's challenge, is to deal with that internal demand as opposed to these external threats. And that is not something that Israel can deal with by defeating. Israel cannot defeat its own internal population. That's not a war. That's a social political phenomenon. I think that, in the end, is going to be Israel's major challenge after it's dealt with the suicide bombers and the would-be nuclear bombers, has to deal with the internal Palestinians.
If I may just ask a follow-up to that. You mentioned that once the Palestinians would be defeated, then the rest of the Arab world would not feel like they have a player in the fight anymore. But since the rest of the Arab world would not itself be defeated, why would they, let's say 90% of the Palestinian people felt defeated, there would still be probably in any society a 10% that would not be defeated, and the rest of the Arab world would just look at the 90%, call them traitorous or whatnot, and just support the other 10%. Why wouldn't that happen?
In theory, that could happen. Sorry. In terms of practical politics, I get these bouts of coughing. In terms of practical politics, I don't think that's likely. If it's higher numbers, 90% of Palestinians said, okay, Israel's there, we accept that it's there, we don't like it, but it's there, and we're going to tend our own garden. I see it very difficult for Moroccans, Egyptians, Iranians, Malaysians to sustain this esprit and to keep this going. It's too superficial. It's in a highly emotive issue, but it's not part of the fabric of their daily lives. And so if the people for whom it is part of the fabric of their daily lives give it up, I see great difficulty for others to sustain it.
All the way in the back, ma'am.
The glorification of martyrdom is part of the unhappy evolution of West Bank and Gaza since 1994. Yasser Arafat, in those early years, talked about the PA, Palestinian Authority, becoming the Singapore of the Middle East. And yet, the policies he adopted, and he also talked about accepting Israel's existence as a Jewish state, and yet, the policies he adopted were quite the contrary. Building up the suicide machine, engaging in tremendous graft, tyranny, incitement. I urge you, if you're ever interested to see the texture of this, to look at a website run by Palestinian Media Watch. And this group just looks at the television and reads the newspapers and magazines and listens to the radio and monitors the sermons and so forth. And wall to wall, what you get from the PA today, textbooks for the children, media, political rhetoric, mosque sermons, posters on the wall, names of sports clubs after suicide bombers. Everywhere you can find, you see a glorification of martyrdom, of suicide bombing, of death, which you'd never see, I believe, ever. And I've never heard of anyone able to point to an exception, is a map of Palestine that is alongside of Israel. It always replaces Israel. That is a symbol of everything that comes out of the Palestinian Authority, which is not to say that every Palestinian buys it. My estimate is that 20% of Palestinians reject this and do accept Israel. And that's a start, but it's a weak start, and they're not in a position to have their way in nearly anything. It is the 80% that dominate. And the challenge before us is to grow that 20%, so that 60, 70, or 80, or even 90%. But it needs to be substantially more than what it is at present.
Okay, we have time for one more question. ma'am on the right? Sorry.
I'll make
or both. And we'll give a brief answer. Okay.
many other factors that can be problems.
Sure. 2 points in response, why I don't point to Israel. One is that under Israeli control before 1994, I mean, while Gaza was hardly paradise, it was certainly better than it is today. There were functioning institutions. Gazans could move around freely without roadblocks. They could go to Israel almost freely. There's something in the West Bank, they could move entirely freely to Israel. The economy had grown. Universities were being founded. I don't want to say it was paradise, but it was a whole lot better than it has been since 1994. Now, why has it been so bad, and why is it so bad today? Because of the Palestinian intent to destroy the neighbor, to use suicide bombers to wear away, erode the will of the Israelis to sustain their Zionism. Were the Palestinians to stop that, were there to be, say, a year of no, or even a month, of no attempts at terrorism, at no incitement? Were the textbooks starting to change their quality? All those things I just mentioned, the political rhetoric, the posters, the sermons, were there in fact not attempts to engage in terrorism, which there are so many every day, the Israelis would note and would ease up. But the Israelis can't, because this determination is there. Now, it does get cyclical, in that when somebody's brother is killed by the Israelis, that somebody might want to go out and kill the Israelis too. But and I acknowledge that, but the initiative is on the Palestinian side. The Palestinians took the PA and turned it into a source of attacks, violent attacks on Israel, and it is up to the Palestinians to end that. I don't know what the Israelis can do. All they can do is try and protect themselves via something like the wall, have excellent intelligence, as they do these days. It's very rare for a terrorist operation to get through, and otherwise think of creative new ways to protect themselves from this aggression. When the Palestinians wish to stop it, then the Israelis will pull off, or will pull back. So no, I don't see it as Israel's responsibility. When the Palestinians give up, I see what you mean. Right. Right. I specifically do not talk about that. The last thing the Palestinians should be hearing is what benefits they might get in the future. I believe the Palestinians need to go through a despair, need to go through a sense of defeat. And then, when that has happened, opens the season to boundaries, sanctities, discussions over boundaries, sanctities, armaments, water and other resources, residential rights, who lives where, all that is to, there's a lot that can be discussed, and indeed it was started in the Oslo process. There was not just the direct Israeli-Palestinian negotiation, but there was also all those other, all the things I just mentioned. All that, there's a lot to discuss. And I wish them well in their discussions. But I am not going to now say, well, the boundaries should be here and Temple Mount should be divided in this way. No, those are to be decided in the future. And I think it's a great mistake to talk about that now. Now is the time for this war to be ended, and ended in the only way it can end, which is by one side giving up. Thank you so much for your interest in your question.
Thank you, everyone, for coming, and I urge you to continue discussing this with each other. On behalf of Kolenu and the Columbia Law School, thanks for coming, and thank you to Dr. Pipes for sharing his thoughts with us.